Brother John.
Good morning, Jerry.
Hey, we made it. We're here.
Yes, we are here.
How's your weather?
Oh, it's about 70 now and for the 4th of July weekend. It looks like it's going to hang in the 70s and probably at least through Monday we're going to have clear weather. Little rain on Tuesday, but it looks like it's going to be a great weekend.
To really enjoy one's weather, whether it's Austin or Chicago, you need to have one of those Bro Show t-shirts. And you can get them at shirt.thebro.show.
Well, we got some cool stuff to talk about today. This is an interesting show, I think.
Yeah, we're going to be bouncing a little around here, but at the beginning...
There's a theme.
But there is a theme.
Yes. Now, we're going to start out talking about sports, of course. Then we're going to talk about film, and then we're going to talk about the fake news. But it's going to take a little different format. We're going to talk about parody in sports, in particular golf. And this theme of parody has something to do with our film and also our news. So I'll let you take it, John.
Sounds good. Well, a couple weeks ago, I had an opportunity to go up to Milwaukee and to watch some baseball. And little did I realize I was going to be right in the thick of the U.S. Open. Which was being played about 35, 40 miles away from Milwaukee. So it kind of got me kind of in the spirit of watching some of these of golf, which I haven't, I kind of have a passing interest in. And it the big talk was the fact that the winner of that tournament was the seventh one in a row, which a different person had won a major championship. Now, when we talk major championships in golf, which is we have what we call the contemporary major championships that were called the Grand Slam or the four biggies, they include Masters, U.S. Open, British Open, and the PGA Tournament. So it kind of brings forth people. You know, there's been a lot of talk about we need to have a dominating player. We need a Tiger Woods out there. to lead the charge, so that and so it brings up the question: parody is parody that good? And I have an expression to be rather blunt. I personally believe parody sucks, and we could talk about parody in a variety of sports. Every sport is confronted with the challenge, and whether you talk about team sports such as football, baseball, basketball, hockey, or you could be talking about individual sports such as golf or tennis.
Right.
So I think the way that the whole business of golf works is that they seem to succeed a lot better and are more popular, particularly with a broader base of fans following them, if they have domination.
Right.
So here we are. We're confronted with a situation where we have we don't have parity. In fact, right now the latest. Period of domination, you'd have to go back to Tiger Woods winning a major tournament back in 2008 for you to come up with, where Tiger's officially...
Almost 10 years.
So we're talking almost 10 years. In the interim, we've had probably, you're always kind of, if a guy wins two majors in a row, all of a sudden you have the new Tiger. And we've had a couple people come and step up and be in that position. We've had Rory McIlroy and also Jordan Spieth have won two in a row of the majors, but it's just been kind of false starts.
Yep.
So the thing is, but has golf had these dry spells before? And the answer is of course. Yes. And if you take a look back, before Tiger Woods, we'd go back. Tiger Woods won his first major back in 1997. So if you then say, well, what happened? How far back from that do you have to go in order to come up with the domination? And we've got Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, and Arnold Palmer, which kind of finishes up with Jack at a rather old age of 46, winning the 1986 Masters. And where does that domination start? Starts probably back with Arnold Palmer winning in 1958. So we've got, a period here where, and actually that's our heyday of golf.
You and I.
And myself, because we were caddies in the early 60s. So as a result, we were kind of got the golf bug in terms of a little bit playing, a little bit working, and also a little bit as a fan of the PGA Tour. So we were kind of caught up with this. And it's kind of interesting because even the Grand Slam, which is what they call winning these, you know, these majors, has a variety of forms. You have the ultimate Grand Slam is of course would be to win all four of these tournaments in one season.
One year.
And in its current format, that has never been done. Because basically the tournaments that make up this have all different lives. I mean, you might think that the Masters is the, traditional. It has all the splendor. It's got a lot of history.
And the jacket,
the green jacket. It's got all this tradition. It's the youngest. It doesn't start till the mid-30s.
Right.
So that means that you really couldn't have a Grand Slam in the form we have it right now until that happened. And actually, the term Grand Slam for this didn't really come about until Arnold Palmer won the first two back in 1960 and said, wouldn't it be neat if I could win the Grand Slam of golf? And he kind of coined the phrase.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't either until probably a little bit until yesterday, and I did a little research. The other thing is that there are other forms of slams. Of course, you could have a career slam. You could win all four within your golf career.
Your career, yeah.
And they got a new one called the Tiger Slam.
What's that?
Tiger Slam is one where you win four consecutive, but over two years.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, So it's kind of interesting to look back on golf. We lived the 60s with.
Yep.
And what happened is you've got Arnold starting it with his domination. And by the way, when we talk about parity or in having that one central figure, quite often it's better to have two or three. And, you know,
well,
we know
it was
that
a great time. The 60s were wonderful.
It was. It's a golden age. Everybody probably has their golden age of golf. But I believe that having Palmer, soon thereafter, you have Gary Player, and then you have Jack Nicklaus, all fairly, you know, within Arnold's a little bit older than and Gary, a little bit older than Jack. But still, I'll never forget when we had an opportunity in the summer, probably sometime in the mid-60s, of seeing both Palmer and Nicklaus play 18 holes where we followed them around the course.
Wow, that was great. That was really great.
It was mesmerizing. We had a couple of club pros, they played a course there. And, I right now in my mind think this was in the middle of the summer. This is a weekend.
Yeah.
Aren't these guys supposed to be in a golf tournament? I don't even know the circumstances under which we were able to get this unique opportunity to do that. And so that was an amazing treat for me. I also remember following the St. Louis, where we're both from, has had the last time they had a major was back in 1965, where they had the U.S. Open at the Belle Reve Country Club.
Oh, Belle Reve.
I remember going out
Good
there.
Course.
Belle Reve. Yeah, it was the new Belle Reve, which was fairly new at the time. And I remember following my favorite was I spent an afternoon, the pairings were Sam Snead playing with Jack Nicklaus.
Oh, man. That
so in other
cool.
words, you have, and that's basically the prior domination period lies with Snead and Hogan. So to see, you know, sort of like two guys from two different generations of golf play together. And I just got such a thrill that Sam Snead that day actually had a better round than Nicklaus did.
Yeah, he held his own.
Wow, isn't this neat? Yeah. Golf has always fascinated me because the players can play for a longer time. I mean, major sports, you usually peak out when you're 30 years old. When golf, you can still be a very competitive golfer going into your 40s, which means that you have these much longer careers.
Right. So, right. If you have a good swing and you don't wreck your back.
And that's the occupational hazard as we've
it is been, as Tiger knows.
Yeah, Tiger has kind of brought that to the forefront rather than its performance.
Right.
I don't know what your impressions were back then, Jerry, but
it was
incredible.
It was a golden. Yeah, it was a golden era. I think the phrase is correct. You know, we were caddies, but we weren't just caddies. I mean, we caddied at a really nice golf course, Sunset Hills. And, you know, we had a great caddy master, Chick Belchick. Yes. He was from Belgium and, or Czechoslovakia, I think. I can't remember. Somewhere in Eastern Europe, had a little bit of an accent, big, tall guy, about 6'3" and, really nice guy. And, you know, he was a good caddy master and him and the boys trained us. And, you know, we had to take tests and we were licensed PGA caddies. We could have caddied in any tour. And I actually got to, caddy for a semi-pro guy for quite a while. And it was what a treat. I learned so much. And so I got a real appreciation for the sport. I was never any good at it. Didn't have any desire, you know, and you know, the odd thing was well, I don't want to digress too much, but we basically, we were, you know, our family was kind of upper middle class. Our father was a business owner and he actually belonged to a country club, but he felt it was important for us to have this experience because he was a caddy when he was a kid and that's how he came up. And that's how he learned about business and the business community. And, you know, he was absolutely right. And So here we were kind of misfits. These other guys we caddied with were different than us. And their money, a lot of times, would go to their mom and dad so they could pay rent. So they were in a very different situation. We learned a lot in a very short period of time. And it was a real, real experience. And I'm so glad we did it.
Yeah, I believe that the opportunity to see, you know, the economics of life through caddy. I mean, we were right there with the members who were some of the more successful business people in the St. Louis area.
I think it crafted our social ethos too. You know, when you caddy and they don't even use your name, they call you boy. You know, you're put in your place, and you know you're humbled by it, and at the same time a little angered by it. So that was the 60s, the early 60s. Yeah. So that fashioned my views of the civil rights movement and everything.
But the fact is, as I was saying, you had the high with respect to the businessman, and then you're sitting right beside a professional caddy who is, you know, just getting a loop so he can get his next bottle of wine.
That's not a professional caddy, John.
Well, you know, I consider a professional caddy a guy who that was his livelihood.
Okay, all right, that's pretty liberal. I have a rather broad definition of
professional caddy. I mean, I could call him a bum too, but that just trying to be kind.
That's what they were called. It was an experience. Yeah, when you come out of the bushes and go up to the clubhouse to take a loop, that's an experience.
So, you know, we can take a look, and there have been these other dry periods. And, you know, it's kind of interesting what happens. And why is this important? Well, the fact is, just like any other sport, you know, money is the bottom line. And TV sponsors, you know, want you to be watching. And, you know, we could take a variety of roads here and talk about the development of how TV fits in into et cetera. But the bottom line is that TV is an important revenue source for the PGA.
Right now,
you do better when you have more fans, and rather than just having the typical fan that follows golf all the time, you latch on to these new fans who basically get caught up in, you know, something such as Tiger Woods' domination of sport. And I mean, there are little things going on right now that kind of can buffer that to some extent. The latest being, you know, if you have a player that's been on the tour for a long time and they haven't won a major, they sort of get a following because somebody says, well, gee, maybe this will be the one they can win it.
We
got Greg Norman, the Australian back in the 80s. Took him forever, and it always seemed like he'd get so close and then screw it up at the end. Mm-hmm. You have Phil Mickelson, who's a current golfer. You've got the most recent one. Is a guy named Sergio Garcia who won the Masters this year, and he's like in his late 30s.
Right.
So he was kind of a possible rival with Tiger that never really culminated. So you've got you've got other little things that kind of could pique interest. But the bottom line is, I think right now it would be good for golf if they could just get somebody to kind of win a string of tournaments or win some majors and.
Get some excitement
actually
back
have somebody
in it.
We could follow.
Yeah, and the problem here is that right now there's a lot of parity in golf, and the diehards, the guys who are really into golf, like it. I mean, you know, they're like you are with baseball. They're into the deets, they're into the details and stuff like that. So that's great for them. But you know, the real win here is when you can have like a superstar kind of guy, or gal, and you want to be able to have that in a sport because it brings in people from the margins. And then you have a bigger crowd. Then there's more money. Then there's more everything. And everyone wins. Even the diehard fans don't care. They like it no matter what. So
yeah,
it's kind of important for the economics of it and the general visibility of the sport. Because since Tiger Woods, what's happened?
Not much, you know, in terms of, like I said, there's been some false starts is what it boils. Mm-hmm. And just to kind of put this in perspective as we finish this up, fact is that you've got about, you know, you got 52 weeks in a year, probably about 45 of those. We've got golf, the tour, you know, the basically the season.
Right.
You've got 150 golfers that are usually going to be playing, of which there's we could spend lifetime discussing how you become a pro golfer and get into the circuit.
Oh, yeah.
And then you've got, of course, the cut that takes place in a tournament, where you've got, you know, usually after two rounds of the four, you cut down from the 150 to 75. So, you know, you could see that, you know, you got a limited number of tournaments, you got players, and that shuffling of players, the turnover of the players within the 150 that get to play these tournaments is pretty big. And you know what? We play golf, we know, and golf is a kind of sport that once you think you've got it licked, you're in trouble.
Oh,
it's going to come and bite you in the butt.
Oh, big time.
And you know what? That happens at all levels. We've seen it. We've seen the meltdowns, you know, through the history of golf.
Right.
So these are the things that make it difficult to have domination. So that's how come it's unique. It isn't, you know, it's something we really strive to have. And I agree with you, Jerry, that I look forward to our next period of domination, and we'll just have to see when that happens.
Yeah, it would be great. Yeah, I mean, everybody wins when there's a king. Speaking of kings.
King, yes.
Speaking of kings, boy. We have a movie. We have a great film.
The King's Speech. We have a movie. And I think we just need to understand that we kind of piqued our interest when we saw Jerry brought to my attention an article, which we'll eventually talk about from the Newsday, that talks about the changing face of the monarchy, the English monarchy. And that made us think about the fact that, you know, the changing face is not something that happened just, you know, that's not something modern. There's been a change, you know, that goes back to this movie, which goes back into the mid-30s. And it's sort of like when I took a look at it, I have an expression I use to describe the challenges of living in a family, and that is, find me the functional family. And we're still in search of it even after going through, because we have there's a lot of moments of dysfunction in the history of the monarchy, but we're going to concentrate on looking at it from the
some
movie
of them lethal,
the
by the way.
Yeah.
Some of them end up in decapitation or what have you.
Ooh, yeah, we don't want to go that far back, Jerry.
Sorry. But anyways, it's there. I mean, you know, the thing is, those guys live with it. It's, for us, it's like history. But for them, it's their family, in a way.
Their lives.
Yes, and they're affected by it. And so the reason we thought this kind of fit in, too, was we were talking about parody, and parody sucks and all that stuff. One of the things about the British monarchy is there isn't parity there. I mean, they live in a different world than the rest of the people in the UK, and people are fascinated by it and they like it. They want it. I mean, no, there's talk about eliminating it and all that stuff within the UK, but you know what? People do like it. And even people here in the US, of course, if they come over here to visit and we want to see them, you know, it's not parity. It's not equal opportunity. They are very privileged. But what you find out from this movie is that there's a great line in the thing where the movie is about King George VI trying to give a speech, and he has a terrible stammer. I mean, a really bad one. And so he goes to a guy to get to cure it, essentially. And it's difficult, very difficult because of his circumstances and all the things he goes through. And here's a cool one I like is his wife. The queen, she shows up and she meets, this guy's, the trainer's wife, Mr. Loeb, Lionel Loeb. So she meets him and she says she's trying to arrange, training for her husband, and he doesn't put it together. And they're not king and queen yet. This is right before. So he doesn't really recognize her. And he's like treating her like anybody else. And he's got all these rules and he's enforcing them. No, you have to come here. No, I can't go someplace else. And, you know, and so he said, well, Does he, maybe he should get a different profession if he has to do public speaking as a stammer. She said, well, he can't. And he says, indentured servitude? And she says, of a sort.
Yeah.
So we don't see that, of course. All we see is the privilege and the glory and the wonderfulness. But they live in a very constrained life with protocols and rules that are staggering and create a tremendous amount of pressure for a guy who's still a 5-year-old kid in his mind trying to get a sentence together.
Mm.
So that's the framing of the movie.
Right. The background of this movie is incredible, too. I mean, we've got, first thing, this movie came out in 2000. The history is obviously a big piece of it, but the making
the history of the movie, yeah.
Yeah, the history of the movie is what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
and first
yeah.
thing, this movie was made in 2010. It was a winner of like 4 Academy Awards, picture, best actor by Colin Firth, who plays King George VI. We've got the director and we've got the screenwriter. And I think for me, with respect to the development and the actual making of this movie, the most interesting thing about it is the screenwriter, who basically has come up with this idea of doing this movie primarily because he is a stammer himself.
Yes.
And so David Seidler is his name. And he comes up with this idea back in the 80s, but he is basically told by the Queen that she doesn't want the movie made until not Queen Elizabeth, but her mother before that. And so as a result, he's holding a script together, and it's not in its formal final stage, waiting basically for her to pass away so that he can then readdress
yes.
making of this movie.
Yes.
I think that's kind of interesting. She
very.
I guess what would we call her? The Queen Mum? I forget.
Yeah,
exactly
that's her name. That's who she
yeah.
is.
She felt that to relive the anguish that they went through back in the 30s and in the 40s with respect to the coronation of eventual coronation of King George VI would be just too much for her to have to take.
Yeah.
So that I thought was an interesting, a very interesting part of the movie. The other thing is that, you know, trying to collect all the information in order to, you know, all the background research that was done, within just weeks of starting the movie,
yeah.
they came across, what did they come across, Jerry?
Some letters.
Correspondence letters, yes.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how the letters
changed the
correspondence.
Movie.
They actually fit in several very key places in the movie, which are just, it adds a kind of little comic relief. It adds some, it makes it human to some extent.
Very.
To put some of these things in there.
Yeah, now the letters are between King George and Lionel Loeb, his trainer.
Right. And it's kind of funny that you talk about the speech therapist setting the ground rules. He even resorts to using King George VI, sort of like his family nickname called Birdie.
Yeah.
And he found that it was amazing how appalled, you know, he was when he heard somebody, a commoner, refer to him by that name. So it was kind of
interesting. Only his family used that name.
Yes. And that brings us to the family and really what King George VI had to go through to get here. And this is where talking about dysfunctional, his upbringing, you know, what the speech therapist Lionel was able to determine was that, you know, the background in terms of his upbringing was a tremendous influence and effect upon him in terms of his stammering. And Jerry,
oh,
maybe
cause.
You can talk a little bit about
yeah.
that. It was
the poor guy. I mean, when he was a baby, basically 2-3 years old, they would have a viewing every day where the nannies would bring the two boys, Edward and Bertie, into the viewing area so the royals could view their children. Which, right there, you know, that says it all, right? These are not hands-on
no.
parents. These are
no.
not affectionate, loving people. I mean, they love their kids, I'm sure. But they are so hidebound by all these protocols and rules and all the duties they have. They live in a castle, for Christ's sake. And so they come in for the viewing, and this one nanny did not like Bertie. And so she would pinch him while during the viewings so that he would cry and they would have to take him out of the room. So he was always feeling like, you know, the black sheep, the bad guy and all that stuff.
Nanny kept food from him.
Really terrible things. It took 3 years for his parents to even notice. And to right there when at that point in his life where he's telling Lionel about this, it was shortly after his father died and he was having a personal moment with him, which was kind of rare. And he just told him, you know, I still can't eat right. And, you know, he had to wear braces on his legs so he wasn't knock-kneed. And, you know, he went through hell. I mean, we think of these guys as privileged and that anything they want, but this guy was damaged. He was scarred. And he had to take over because his goddamn brother wanted to marry someone that threw him out of the king position. He had to abdicate. And his brother was a jerk anyway, played by Guy Pearce, who was incredibly good at it.
Yeah.
And you get so much history in this movie, so much. And Churchill's in it, and Spall, Anthony Spall, is that his name?
Right.
Yeah, he plays him and does a great job.
Timothy Spall.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I love that actor anyway. And he does some great stuff. And he's so good with the king. You can see why, you know, he was who he was. They just had some great lines, you know, from history, too. All this stuff happened. So it was really neat. I mean, God, what a movie. I've watched this at least 5 times. I watched it right before we came on.
Yeah, I had an opportunity just a couple of days ago to watch it for the first time. And you know, the thing is, typically what you – your history is you go back and think in terms of what you learned in school. It kind of – the highlight of it was the abdication by
Edward.
Edward. Yeah. And which he held, you know, he was a king for a very short period of time, but felt the need to, he had to abdicate because he was going to marry a woman. He wanted to marry a woman who was twice divorced.
And her husbands were still alive.
Live, yes. Yeah. So, you know, the other thing that's kind of interesting about what brings this forth with the speech is that we are now into the age of radio.
Yeah.
So probably, you know, 100 years before that, this wouldn't have been quite as big a problem. But the predecessor king, who would be, what, King Edward V, I guess? Passed away. He felt it was important that the monarchy take on this new technology.
King George. Right. And his son, when he took over... His second son took over. He just added 6.
Right.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's easy to get caught up in these numbers.
Oh, yeah. And these names. Had like 5 names.
Jeez.
I know.
And so the result of all this is that kind of, because of technology and the king feeling there, it's important that the monarchy communicate with the masses with this new technology that really puts the stammering out there for everybody to see. And the challenges and the different methodology that's used. And believe me, this movie has so many ups and downs in terms of the relationship between Lionel, the speech therapist, and Bertie, King George, who later becomes obviously King George the VI. It's like there's a falling out at least 3 times during the movie. Where they,
correct.
You know, the king, you know, the
wants to pitch it and forget it. Let's not do this.
Yes.
You can't take it anymore. Not because of the training. It's just because he has to confront his demons. That's what's really at the bottom of all this stuff. And he can't do it. And he doesn't want to talk about his personal life. And he does anyway. And Lionel is very crafty and he brings these things out. And the cool thing is they end up being like close friends, actually. And he pointed out during the movie, "You're the only commoner I've ever talked to, period." And you just think about that. This guy has never talked to anyone but servants and members of his family. He's totally cloistered, lives in a bubble, and, you know, he has never talked to, quote, the common man. But here is the change, and this is what's important about our article coming up. the monarchy starts to change. And I think, John, you hit it on the head, radio. That really changed it, because suddenly, before that, as King George V points out to Bertie, before that, you just had to look good in uniform and not fall off your horse. Those were two requirements. Pretty funny, huh? So, that's a requirement. Now, he said, we've been reduced to the most vile profession on earth. We're actors. We have to. And so, the thing is they are coming into people's homes via the radio. So, here, this is where the parody starts to break down. You're going to be able to hear the king talk, and he's talking to you. And when on earth are you ever going to be able to talk to your king one-on-one? And you feel like that with the radio. So it starts to break down. The distance and the, like I said, the cloistered aspects of being, it starts to break down with that radio. And it started with King George V, and it really ramped up with the VI, because sure enough, within I don't know how long, they were at war with Germany. And that country depended upon two people to get through that war. One of them was Churchill, who was magnificent. He was born to do that. I mean, he was a great commander in chief, but also this guy had a heart. I mean, you know, after they'd bomb all night, the Luftwaffe, he would go out the next morning and go to every site that was bombed, talk to people, clear bricks, try and find people. I mean, and he would cry in public about what had happened at that site. And he didn't put on, he was completely genuine. And then there was the king. King George VI was a brick. I mean, this guy, because of what he had gone through in his life and overcame, he was really an inspirational character. And a lot of people say, between Churchill and George VI, they held on. And they would have never been able to otherwise. They would have capitulated or what have you. And there were a lot of people, like including the king that abdicated, that liked Hitler. Believe it or not.
That's hard to believe.
It's but, true, though.
Oh, it is. I mean, we had the same thing in the States. We had the isolationists. That was a nice term for people who basically said, look, this isn't our war. I'll let them fight it out in Europe. And, you know, whatever happens, happens.
But yeah, we got enough resources. We're okay.
Yeah,
the thing sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It does. But this movie, the historic setting that it's placed in with respect to the war is a critical piece in terms of King George VI, because even after he gets coronated, he goes through having to maybe say three or four sentences about during the coronation. But then he's confronted with the fact that he has got to address the nation in terms of the war, and this is not going to be like a one or two sentence speech.
No, and he had a hell of a time during the coronation, given the two sentences.
Yes, yeah, he had no trouble with that. So, but it went relatively smoothly. So he's got Lionel right there. He's sort of like a coach right there, just after every sentence, kind of pushing him on. And it was amazing to watch that part gives that speech.
Oh, Lionel's right in front of him, right in his face. And they have little tricks they do to get him through the words he has difficulty with. And they're very funny.
Swearing.
Because they use swearing as a means of doing it. So they swear to themselves, you know, during the speech. And you can see Lionel mouthing the curse words to get old Bertie through the rough spots. And he has to even kind of, he does a thing on purpose. He has trouble with M's. So he goes, first. Before he actually says the word. So it sounds like a little bit of a, you could say, oh, that's a royal affectation, which they have plenty of in their speech. But they use stuff like that. It was really breathtaking to watch. That is the culmination of the movie when they get through that.
It is. Right? And what's the thing is that to just bring back to what we were talking about in terms of the development of this, first thing you got to realize that this speech is so important because it's sort of like getting your country behind a cause, the war, you know, it's
and they just been through a war.
Yes. You know, we're not that far away from World War One. The other thing though, is at the end of it, where the comic relief comes in and the letters is the fact that at the end of it, Lionel can't help but tell Bertie, well, by the way, you know, there was a couple places where you had trouble with the W, saying the words with W on it, And the comeback is so incredibly good. Jerry, what's the comeback Birdie comes?
Birdie says, I did that intentionally. They had to know it was me.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't think somebody else gave my speech.
I screw up a little bit.
Exactly. Which was very clever. Very clever. I liked it. It was so cool. And he was so happy after he gave that speech. Colin Firth just does an incredible job. And, you know, he does a great job of talking about the despair and the just desperation and futility he felt. And so defeated. What a defeated man. And he came back from that. He had to be king. He didn't want to be king. Goddamn brother flaked out, and he had to do it. So he did.
That's the part of history that we usually remember, the fact that the king abdicates and becomes the Duke of Windsor. And, you know, because he lives for a fair long period after that, but you're constantly reminded of it just because of, you know, his carryings on and this and after, you know, that. So that was really, really good.
Oh, he had to give this speech because there was a big movement to have Edward come back because a lot of people liked him. He was a smooth character. He was a good public speaker. He was handsome. You know, all kinds of good things about this guy. And they're willing to overlook all this stuff with his crazy wife. But and that was part of the pressure that was on Birdie, too. I mean, they're placards. When Birdie would go someplace to a public thing, people would be holding up signs, bring back Edward, our king. You know, and so he had like pressure, unlike I think anyone ever experiences in their life.
Another piece of irony about this that Lionel, when he first, has his, you know, they have the speech therapy going on, and Birdie brings out a cigarette and smokes and starts to smoke, and Lionel says, no smoking. And apparently, through his series of speech therapists that he'd gone through, he had been told that smoking could actually kind of calm his nerves and improve
relax the larynx,
his ability, relax them and make them give him a better platform upon which to talk. And the irony lies in the fact that King George VI died in his mid-50s of complications from lung cancer because he kept smoking.
Yeah. Well, he couldn't stop. I mean, that guy had, again, so much pressure, et cetera. And the cool thing, the line was, I believe, it was something along the lines of, he says, well, I've been advised it relaxes the larynx. He said, well, I believe they kill you. Sucking in smoke, it will kill you. And he said, well, these people all told me this. We're knighted. And he said, well, then it's official.
They're official idiots.
Well, yeah, they're idiots. That's what he said. They're idiots. And he said, well, they've all been knighted. He said, well, then it's official. Oh, man. He has a great lines in this, and I think that stuff came out of the letters too. Maybe I don't know.
Yes, but I think it did.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Good stuff.
So this movie gives you an opportunity to not only see the best movie of 2010, but it gives you a chance to relive and learn history. And it's kind of amazing because you can only do so much. And the other thing is, quite often there's you think in terms of time. This movie is like a little less than 2 hours. It's an hour and 58 minutes. It moves fast.
Correct. It just zips
through. And so there's no way that they can bring up, you know, but what it does is it gives you the pieces of history that are very, very important as it relates to this. But then your mind can continue to take it a step further and think about the whole World War, Dunkirk, Neville Chamberlain, and the non-aggression pack. Oh, it just opens up the windows for you to think about the other stuff that's going on at the same time.
Yes. Now, the interesting thing here is we're talking about parody, right? Now, the current royals have been affected by what went on in that movie, or, you know, not in the movie, but in that segment of history. As I said, right, the democratization of the monarchy, in a sense, started then with radio. And of course, it just continued. Now that once you have paparazzi and film and TV and all this stuff, it just gets more so. So now, you know, we've got the current royals, who are a very interesting kettle of fish.
I just want to kind of do a little transition here between
the two. Sure.
Because the fact is that there are certain events you remember when you grow up and say, "What was the first thing you remember?" One of the first things I remember as a kid was watching, after King George VI passes away, is watching the coronation on TV.
Of Queen Elizabeth.
Yes, of Queen Elizabeth.
Yep. 52? Is that 52?
1952. So here I am. I'm, 6 years old, maybe five or six. But I clearly remember that being such a significant newsworthy event. So what we've got is we've got radio. Then the next step is when we have a new person in the monarchy, we're exposed to television.
Yes. Yes,
so
it was televised.
I thought that was kind of interesting. So here we are. We're moving on. In fact, that queen is still alive. That was coronated in 1952. That's Queen Elizabeth.
The daughter.
She's the daughter, and as a result, and she's like 91, or I think she's 91 years old,
right?
At this point, and so she had to go through her own, transformation of and basically what's happening during the monarchy. So now here we are now at a point in time where obviously we are going to, her death is imminent. She's
right.
91 years old. And so there's thoughts about, well, how is this all going to transpire? Well, there's a little event that takes place in the interim, and that is Prince, we've got the next person in line is Prince Charles.
Right.
The son.
Our age. The guy who's our age. My age.
Yeah, he's about our age. Which brings forth another part of the dysfunctional piece to this family, which we don't necessarily have to get into, but it obviously is going to play a part in what happens when the queen passes away.
Right.
Because we're going to have a king that comes on board who's going to be well into his 70s.
Exactly.
So the time frame, it's kind of a little unique situation. And maybe you can talk a little bit, Jerry, about how that plays into the article that we read and what's the changing face of the monarchy.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of background in this thing. And if you followed it over the years, or if you even just kind of catch up on what's going on, there's a lot of talk that Queen Elizabeth just does not want her son Charles to be king. And, a lot of people have said over and over, why don't you just abdicate and let him take over? Because there are a fair number of people who like him, and he's very progressive. He's very active in the environment. He's active in a lot of good charities and stuff like that. And at this point, she is getting older. And as it turns out, she's like sharing a lot of her duties with him. A lot of people refer to him as a co-regent because he's, he's doing a lot of the stuff that she used to do, so she doesn't have to do it. And he's kind of apprenticing. So I think that her earlier thoughts about trying to figure out a way to, just get one of his boys in there and not him is going to fail because he is going to be king. I don't see any way around it, but he has a little complication too. And that is the fact that, he pitched over Princess Diana because he was in love with another woman, even when he married her, carried on with her and all this stuff. So, he's kind of doing a little bit of an Edward thing here, his own version of it. And he did end up marrying her, and she is a divorced woman whose husband is still alive. And so they've relaxed some of those rules.
Right.
So I think it's still going to work out for him, king, but there's a little bit of a cloud over that. And his own sons are not terribly fond of him because of this, because they loved their mother and felt like she got a raw deal. And, of course, they're very, very aware of it. And, read the article. The article in Newsweek, I think it is, isn't it?
Newsweek is what it is, yes.
Yeah. So there's this article in Newsweek, and it basically centers around Harry, who's like second in line. But Harry's talkative. He is a guy who will talk to reporters and let these guys do a story on him. And it's fascinating, I think. You got two brothers, and one brother is kind of, he's an introvert. He's not an extrovert like Harry. Harry likes to be out there. He likes the people. But his brother is more detail oriented and gets into all this stuff. And they're a good team, actually. And
right,
his wife,
compliment
Kate,
each other.
Yeah, his wife Kate is also a big player in all this stuff. She gets involved. So it's like the three of them are really working together to do the things that the royal family needs to do, and they're really doing a smashing job, I think. Harry went to war in Afghanistan, fighter pilot, the whole works, flew a helicopter for Medvac, did a whole lot of great stuff. And so, you know, really interesting guy, and spends a horrendous amount of time even now going to veterans groups, particularly talking about people who've been maimed or injured, and he's right in there with them, and people really like him because he's very real and wants to be an ordinary person as much as possible, something he got from his wife, from his mom, rather.
The important Princess Di plays a big piece in, because what's happened here is that Harry gravitated towards her, and
yep.
her thing was to try to make the monarchy in her limited role
relevant,
as human as possible, make the monarchy open a little bit more and not so standoffish.
Right.
And so that has rubbed off on Harry, and Harry's just taking it a step further, you know, being participating in the Afghanistan, you know, the war in the Middle East, and being a part of that and reaching out to, I'll tell you, when I read this article and saw the number of charities that they're involved in, I mean, that's a big part. You know, they've got their official duties when they have to stand up and make speeches, this and that, whatever.
Right, right.
Openings of certain, you know, things and whatever. But
yeah.
This back duty that they have in terms of basically taking money and trying to decide what charities and what their causes are going to be, it's mind-boggling to me as to how much they do. And they're actually trying, I think, sort it out and try to kind of pare it down a bit so that they can be more effective
in
the causes that they do.
Yeah.
But what's happening here is the fact that you've got a queen who is 91 years old and is not able to – she's still very alert, but she has limited capabilities of doing the causes. So you have this natural delegation that's taking place just purely because of her age. She just can't do all this stuff like she used to.
Right.
And I think that helps in terms of trying to transition to get the new face and change a little bit as to how the monarch is approached.
Oh, absolutely.
I also believe that the challenge lies in the fact that the commoners, the English people are so hung up on transition that they feel that there's an obligation that the monarch has to have this sort of standoffish role, and it's hard to break through. So it isn't what you call the most popular thing to change the monarchy, because the people really, many of them don't want it.
Right.
They're comfortable with what is.
Right. Right. Yeah. When she's from that generation, I mean, you know, she's definitely from that generation, and Harry and William are not. But, you know, one of them is going to be king. And one of the great quotes from the article is, he says, "I don't know anyone in the royal family who wants to be king or queen."
Yes.
Which immediately qualifies him, in my opinion. I feel the same way about the presidency here, right? Anybody who wants to be president is flawed. But anyways, I really like this article. It was a great human interest, and the great thing is that Princess Di, who everybody loved so much, despite all the crazy stuff too, Princess Di, her influence is more alive today, I think, than it ever was, especially if you read this article. You can see that. And, you know, I think it affected Charles too. And, you know, as a background thing, last night, Mary Jane and I watched The Queen with Helen Mirren. And that is a movie about Princess Di getting killed in that automobile accident in Paris. And the aftermath of it, and how poorly she dealt with it, and how the prime minister at that time had to almost talk her into doing anything at all. She was trying to pretend like Princess Di didn't even happen because she was no longer part of the family. And Charles knew immediately, mistake, big mistake, and he wanted to change it, and he wanted to give her the respect she deserved as a princess. And he ended up prevailing, and I think it was a great move. The Spencer family, of course, to this day, I think is very angry still about the way Di was treated, and they know better than anybody what that dysfunctional family, the royal family, really is. And I've got great hopes that William and Harry and Kate will change the face of it. And I like the fact that they're working together. It turns out Harry really likes Kate. he thinks she's great and really good for the family, if you can call it that. Mm-hmm. Remember in the King's Speech, John, where I think it's, is it Edward or is it Bertie? I can't remember. Anyway, their mom says, we're a family. And he says, no, mother, we're a firm.
Yeah, this is a business.
Well, you know, there's two sides of it. There is the business of the monarchy, and then there's family, and they're separate. For instance, today, you know, those boys and Kate, they're not overly fond of Charles, but they're all in the same firm, and they have to work together, and they do. And I think they do a good job. But personally, you know, I don't think you're going to have many more moments between those two groups. It's just because of too much water under the bridge.
I think what the article does for me is it makes me, piques my interest as to, you know, what's going to happen now? Is this going to unfold the way that the article kind of leads us to believe, or is it possible? I'd like to think it is.
Yeah.
That there will be a changing face, and that there will be a more human element to this, to the monarchy, and Harry becomes the face of the monarchy, even though, you know, he's not going to be, he won't be king, but it'll be more of a group effort, the three people, Kate, Edward, and Harry, that'll kind of able to complement each other and make the work that they, their duties and responsibilities, work out a lot better, is the way I look at it.
Yeah, I think it'll be nice. It'll be interesting to see. But again, parody sucks. So they're going to have to play the role as royal because people want that. And in the article, Harry points out people actually need that. Not only do they want it, they need it. And he's right.
Right.
We need aspirational figures. We need, you know, something. And the world as it is today, well, I don't have to say much about it. This is obvious, right? People need aspirational figures. And the monarchy has a great ability. They have a great potential for good in many regards. And I think the work they're doing is inherently good. And I think that'll keep going. So anyway,
yes,
that's it. I mean, I love that. Yeah, that article was great. The movie was great. This observation you made about golf and business with the parody and heroes and all that stuff. It all kind of ties together. People do like heroes.
Yes, they sure do. And it was, it's a lot of great stuff to go through. And it's amazing when we do this. My interest lies in learning new things. And you know, you have something here which you think you know a little bit of, you just know a little bit about, and you want to learn so much more. And then before you know it, you're talking about some pretty important history.
Yeah, and the odd thing, the great thing about being alive today in 2017 is, like, for instance, when I went to rent the movie from Amazon today, first of all, it's $1.99. I think that's a great price. And the second thing was there were follow-up things that they had for the movie that were free. There was a whole thing on the background of that movie and some of the history. And they got a lot of live clips and real stuff from real history. So, I mean, the great thing is if you go doing research for anything, you discover so much more and how it all fits together. You could just dive in and spend days looking at the history of this thing, couldn't you?
Yeah, like the whole thing with the monarchy, and as I learned when I was going through my parody with golf, it's the same thing.
Yeah,
you could go down so many different roads of interesting facts that, and that's part of the challenge as we do these podcasts is to be able to make sure that you don't go down too many roads, make it too complicated, give too much information.
Yeah,
and you kind of stick on the main road as much as you can, and it's a challenge to do that.
Yep, it's not all glamour, is it?
No.
Anyway,
oh boy,
great talk, John. Super.
Okay.
Super.
Sounds good. I'll be talking to you tomorrow.
All right. Adios.
Okay, bye-bye.